This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When someone suggests a weight loss scheme that doesn't involve dieting or exercise, one can't help but be a little skeptical. But I've got one for you anyway. It's simple. All you have to do is turn down your thermostat. James Hamblin is senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes the monthly health column. And that's where we found his article, The Benefits of Being Cold. James, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So what's the general concept here? Why does being cold help you lose weight?
Well, there's a certain amount of caloric energy that goes into heating your body. So when you are cool, your body goes through a process called thermogenesis, generating heat to maintain that 98.6 degree temperature. And so when you shiver, that burns a lot of calories. But somewhere in the middle, there's a process called non-shivering thermogenesis that burns calories without being so miserable as to have you shiver. So that's part of it. But there is also a theory that's it's in its infancy. It's being studied that exposure to cold actually activates some stress response in the body, activates some mitochondrial enzymes that help to maintain homeostasis, help to have your body in an ideal metabolic state to ward off obesity, diabetes, chronic illnesses that we're seeing in large scales today.
And a lot of this research came from a former NASA scientist named Ray Cronus, who is really interesting. You kind of profile him in the story. What is his story?
Ray Cronus is was formerly at NASA and now runs his own experimental lab in his home in Huntsville, Alabama. So in 2010, he was trying to lose weight himself, and he heard the story of Michael Phelps. During his Olympic run, he was going around saying that he was eating 12,000 calories a day. And Cronus heard that and was somewhat incredulous, saying, you know, how could anyone burn that many calories? You know, even an athlete who's running a marathon, a marathon rough average for calories burned is 2,500. So if you eat around 2,000 calories and, you know, you could run a marathon to burn that off, but the extra 7,000 or 8,000 that Phelps is mentioning, he'd have to be swimming 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. It's just not physically possible. So he started thinking about other variables in Phelps' life, and he's spending maybe 6 hours a day training in a cold pool, and there is heat transfer through water is very efficient. So basically the heat energy is being sucked out of him by that water, and he's burning calories just to maintain his core temperature. So Cronus started doing what he called shiver walks, where he'd go outside in winter without a shirt and just walk around, and he'd take cold showers. And he started measuring his own caloric expenditure during those periods and realized that he was burning a lot of calories. Mm-hmm. He actually ended up losing 27 pounds in 6 weeks, which is astounding. He was combining that with diet and exercise. This wasn't the only thing that he was doing. And so after seeing those great results, he decided to make a life of studying the effects of cold exposure on metabolism.
Well, he lives in Huntsville, Alabama. How cold does it get there?
I know. And well, that's part of it. He doesn't advocate extreme cold exposure. So it can dip down into the 50s, and that's what he's talking about is going outside without a shirt in the 50s, when it's in the 50s. Some people who read his story got into taking ice baths and doing more extreme things, and it's not what he's advocating.
Well, I'm wondering about that. I mean, you say it gets down into the 50s. I mean, we're in New Hampshire, where not dressing properly at this time of year is a good way to get frostbite. Isn't it pretty extreme and potentially dangerous to try and lose weight this way?
Absolutely. He is advocating this as an adjunct to diet and exercise. And as he's talking about very simple things like, you know, you might layer to go outside in New Hampshire in the winter, and you should. But when you come in, you don't still need to be wearing everything that you were wearing, you know, the flannel with a sweater over top of it and having a space heater under your desk. Humans are made to survive at temperatures in the 50s and 60s without you won't die. So those are the temperatures. He's saying 50s and 60s. Turn down the thermostat a little bit, and it might have some helpful metabolic effects.
You mentioned that something human beings are made for this, and I'm wondering about historically, how has temperature figured into weight? I mean, I think our ancestors would be a lot more concerned with staying warm than losing weight.
That is a large part of what Cronus and some of his collaborators are arguing here, is that people, for the majority of our evolutionary history, were exposed to cold. Even in tropical regions, people were exposed to more cold than a lot of people are now. We have these constantly heated environments. We go from a heated car to a heated office to a heated home, and we spend very little time outside in the cold. And that heat in a year-round environment is a modern luxury that may factor into what are being called epidemics of obesity and chronic disease that were not present previously, in combination with our diets and our lack of exercise.
Well, you tried something, a product that one man using Cronus's ideas helped to create to shiver away the pounds. It was called an ice vest. What was it like?
Yeah, that's what got me interested in this whole concept is I received an email from a professor named Wayne Hayes about a product that he is beginning to market on a very small scale. It's called an ice vest, and it is meant as an adjunct weight loss tool. It's a canvas vest that's loaded with ice packs, and you're meant to wear it throughout the day at any period that you can, including at work, around the house. You wear it for about an hour or two until your body warms that ice to room temperature. And the inventor, Wayne Hayes, says that that burns about 250 calories. I am skeptical. I think his data he's drawing from is a small pool, but it burns some calories just in the process of heating that ice. And it actually wasn't as miserable as it might sound because it's a heavy canvas vest and you're wearing clothes underneath it. So it's more like having when you might put an ice pack on a sprained ankle.
Okay, so you're not saying the all ice vest alone kind of regimen would work?
No, I don't think anyone's advocating that, and that can be overall bad because if you feel like, oh, I'm wearing the ice vest, so I can just go on the eat as many cheeseburgers as I want, you know, you end up worse off for something like that, and that is a very legitimate criticism of this sort of thing.
You wouldn't be the first dieter to take that tack, however, would we? James Hamblin, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
James writes the monthly health column, and you can read his article about Ray Cronus and his research at wordofmouthradio.org. While shivering may help you shed pounds this winter, one thing is likely to put them back on, and that's comfort food. Up next, we're going to hear from a chef who relishes in reinventing classic, nostalgic dishes. A new twist on meat and potatoes when Word of Mouth returns after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, the cold winter is undeniably upon us. Time to put on some comfy PJs, light the stove, and prepare a hearty meal. But instead of the usual meat and potatoes, why not try something new this year? In his cookbook, Adventures in Comfort Food, Chef Carrie Altiero shares new twists on some time-honored indulgences, from lobster mac and cheese to deconstructed nachos. Carrie Altiero is the chef and owner of Cafe Miranda in Rockland, Maine. And Carrie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Well, all right. How do you define comfort food?
Well, I guess, you know, to say it's comforting wouldn't be not the way to do this. But I think what I really would like to say is things that are familiar, that give you a sense of pleasure, a sense of grounding, things that may not be, in this cookbook, might not be culturally familiar to you, but they will address those same things that, for me, as you see in the cover of the book, Adventures in Comfort Food, spaghetti and meatballs, which is, that's my grandma, that's my Italian-American grandma. But then we'll have Max, we'll have Thai, we have all kinds of different stuff, because every culture has something that is considered like the baseline, the comfort food, whether it's in New England as boiled dinner or a bowl of chowder. You name it, that's what it is.
So where did this eclectic menu from all over the place come? Were you a world traveler?
In my own head. Well, I grew up in the coal mining hills of Pennsylvania, and, you know, I'm a cultural refugee from there. And back in the day when I started cooking, I was a vegetarian in the 70s, which was, you know, besides my Italian-American grandmother looking at me and saying, no meat. Saying, really, no meat? Because, you know, she came from the old country, and, like, not eating meat was like, that's where we came to America, because we had food, you know? So what was the question anyway, Virginia?
I can't remember. Oh, where are you, a world traveler? How did you get all this menu? I'm guessing that you know, I was sort of imagining you going from Thailand to India, all over on a dusty motorbike or something like that and gathering recipes. Did I get it wrong?
Well, we have one element, the motorcycles. Yeah, I was racing motorcycles, but it was in the mid-Atlantic states, and I wasn't traveling around the world. But I think if a lot of your listeners buy this book, I'll have the opportunity to go to India and then to go to Thailand and see where I made a mistake. And I have to borrow a comment from Ray and Tom that I'm unencumbered by actual knowledge or experience other than my own, that I'm self-taught at pretty much everything I've done. A lot of us chefs are trained in one discipline, whether it's Italian or French or whatever it happens to be, but I'm not trained in those disciplines. So I look at everything pretty much equally in terms of hierarchy. I go to places, whenever I go to a city or something, I'll go to Chinatown and look for the place with the steamed up windows and no English and just put down like $20 and shrug my shoulders and go, whatever. And I've been doing that for my whole career for 35 years.
Well, you mentioned comfort food being about familiarity on some level, you know, a kind of grounding, but with all of these unexpected dishes, the curries, you know, ingredients like Thai fish sauce or bamboo shoots or poblano peppers, how do you encourage people to find comfort in new dishes when they, you know, might just go for the garlic mashed potatoes or something?
So here's like how this cookbook works. You try out the garlic mashed potatoes. You say, that was really comforting. And then you say, oh, I'm going to try out the mac and cheese, and that was really comforting. And then you look at that weird thing with the bamboo shoots and go, well, everything else has been pretty good. So I call this, and in the book I call it like my stealth dishes, to draw you in to the style and try those things out. But I think, you know, there's so much different cultural stuff going on, whether it's Max, whether it's Asian, whether it's North African, whatever it is, people are starting to be exposed on a regular basis to different cuisines. I mean, if nobody knew what a vente was, like, a few years ago. So people can be trained, they can be exposed to things. And that's what I find to be interesting about this book and interesting about this food, that once you trust what we're doing, you can look at other cuisines and say, man, look at that. And in that way, you can see that we're not so different.
It's funny, when I think of comfort food, I think of a lot of things that I was raised with, and it wasn't necessarily good food in some cases.
Yeah, okay, cream of mushroom soup.
Well, you know,
and tuna casseroles.
I'm with you. I actually didn't know that garlic didn't come in a shaker until I was, you know, out on my own. That's what my mother cooked with. So this stuff isn't necessarily good for you, but we have associations with it. So how do you make something that, I don't know, doesn't begin with cream of mushroom soup, but has that flavor of old home and, you know, dirty fried onions on a bean casserole kind of thing?
Oh, man, you hit them all. You forgot the crumbled potato chips on the tuna casserole. I mean, I think you nailed them all. It's martinis with Mancini. It's 1965 again. Here we are. What I do is, I couldn't call myself a creative person. I would call myself a food stylist. Hmm. So when you look at our mac and cheese, you look at the pot roast blue in there, or you look at the burritos, they're not necessarily traditionally accurate And some of those things, like, I love tater tots, you know? I mean, but if you put the mashed potatoes in the oven after you make them and brown them, they're kind of like tater tots. So I kind of, like, refer to things like that. But that's really what this is about. It's about a twist on an idea or an interpretation of an idea. Like, our clam chowder is nothing like a traditional clam chowder. But when we put on the menu a year ago, it got rave reviews, and now I would call it one of the sacred cows, if you will, that we can't take off the menu.
You just reminded me of one of the funny names of the dishes, Wu-Tang Clam. It's one of the dishes. There's New Age Chowder. There's NASCAR Pate. I had it in Biddeford. I mean, where did these come from?
Well, you know, I could tell you a bit about my checkered past, but I think your listeners might have a guess. Let's see, I'm 59, raised in the late 60s, early 70s. There's a couple of clues there, I think, for you. But I think that we're very serious about our food, but we're not serious about ourselves. Sometimes a dish comes up for an idea, an ingredient, a methodology, a piece of equipment, or a name. And we had this Chinese fermented black bean sauce. And we were trying out this pork dish. We're trying out the clams. We went, oh, my God, with the clams. So then we just put two and two together and came up with Wu-Tang Clam. I mean, it did drive the editors out of their minds, I have to say, with all this goofiness in here.
What I've noticed also is that the trend of comfort food, I mean, obviously you were on this kind of early, but this is a post 9/11 phenomenon, apparently, this kind of rise in making food at home like your mother used to make. What happens when all that ends, Carrie?
Well, I think that there's a whole bunch of different stuff that goes on with the food of a country. I often think that the cuisine follows the nation, and the nation was scared. And where do you go? You go back to comfort. And it also got another pump into mashed potatoes in 2008 with the economic crash, too. Mm-hmm. If we notice, a lot of restaurants open bistros, which is like your dumbed-down version or a less expensive version. So people really became customer conscious, and they're starting to do that. But comfort food will always be there. But what's interesting within this book, everything in this book is not all heavy stuff. It's not all sauerkraut or brown sauces. There's mangoes, and there's papayas in here, and there's lobster cocktails, and there's bright things. Comfort doesn't mean the flavors of winter. There's places that are hot on Earth that have comfort food. That would be, Southeast Asia. That would be Mexico, all kinds of stuff like that. So I think this one will stand the test of time, but the most important thing that I want your listeners to do is splash red sauce on it, get fingerprints on it, have the pages dog-eared and worn, because this is a book for everyday use. You can eat everything in here, eat it every day. It's healthy, it's good, and it'll really impress your friends.
Why do we cook after all? All right, I'm going to go through a couple different scenarios, and you tell me your go-to comfort food. How's that?
Ooh, oh, boy, I'm on the spot here. I'm ready.
Yeah, okay, so freezing cold, subarctic, 10 below kind of day, like we've been having a little bit here in New England.
Well, yesterday I ate a Thai-style stir-fry, not unlike Pad Thai, with a lot of spice in it. I know it doesn't sound like something you'd eat on a 15-degree day, but it was very satisfying. It has those brown flavors in it, very satisfying. I had pork and shrimp in it with cilantro and peanuts and lime juice and, salt. It was very satisfying.
Okay, another scenario. Brunch with a bunch of old friends that have rediscovered you on Facebook.
Well, first, I hope it never happens. A brunch item. I think I would do one of the lobster cocktails. There's a couple of them in here. There's one that we did at the Cellar Door Winery right up here in Lincolnville. I say in the book here that, if you can't go south, crank up the wood stove, put on your shorts, throw some sand around on the floor, and make this dish and just pretend you're sitting on the beach in Miami having this.
Okay, really hard day of pulling lobster traps, really hard day at the office. You just got to unwind. You got to come in. You got to have something that's going to give you some sense of relief and that it's all worth living.
Oh, swamp chop.
Swamp chop. Okay, that is, tell me.
That is a seared pork chop with a risotto with hot peppers in it, tomato pepper sauce, okra in the risotto. So this one was actually as I was writing the book, and I had to come up with dinner, and I had been on the farm working all day because we have our own farm, which is a mile and a tenth away from the restaurant here, 17-acre farm. We've owned it well before it was a marketing opportunity. And we've been doing, you know, vegetables and getting wood for our wood-fired oven out there. And worked all morning, then I worked late into the night, and I went, oh, my gosh, I don't have any – I didn't think of eating dinner. So I went through the larder. I got the pork chops. I got the peppers from Beth's Farm Market. I had the risotto, had the okra, and it was so satisfying. And made it onto the menu last year, too, for a little while.
So, Carrie, what is your go-to comfort food?
Oh, it's a great story, too. We did the book. We did the pictures. The publisher calls me up and says, what picture do you want on the cover? I says, why don't you pick one? And they picked one, and it was the one that I would have picked, which is my go-to. After I've had all the Thai stuff and I've had the swamp chop and I don't know what I'm thinking, it takes me right back to my Grandma Connie's and my Aunt Florence, known as Auntie Fluffy, and her picture is on the wall here. Spaghetti and meatballs, man. It's like my home base dish. It's the only dish that has never changed on the menu in the 22 years we've been open. Everything else is game, you know?
Well, Carrie, I'm guessing that Nana Connie would say buon appetito?
No, she'd look at you and say, are you sick? You're not eating enough. That's what she would say, but that's okay.
Carrie Altiero, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Ms. Prescott, I do appreciate the opportunity. Hello to your listeners and stay warm.
Carrie Altiero is the chef and owner of Cafe Miranda in Rockland, Maine. You can find a link to read more on his cookbook, including some recipes, Adventures in Comfort Food, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we would love to hear from you. What are your go-to dishes when the weather gets cold? Are you all about meat and potatoes, or do you find comfort in a warm apple pie or something a little more daring? You can share your recipes on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1951, Brownie Wise, a young mother and entrepreneur, traveled from Michigan to Massachusetts for a meeting with businessman and inventor Earl Tupper that would prove to be pivotal. At the meeting, Wise advised Tupper that his food storage product should not be sold in stores, but rather in homes. Tupper hired her on the spot, and the Tupperware party was born. Within 5 years, the company's estimated sales reached $100 million annually. And by the 1990s, 90% of U.S. homes owned at least one item of Tupperware. In 1958, Brownie Wise was unceremoniously fired from the company, but the Tupperware party lived on. In this piece, the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, bring us back to the days of plastic bowls, home parties, and Tupperware conventions.
Somewhere in the world, a Tupperware party is held every 10 seconds.
Come on!
I'm Lucky Laurel, and I'm your Tupperware dealer.
She's Lucky Laurel, and I'm Joyful Joan.
That's Lucky Laurel.
Perky.
I think some people are just Tupperware people. Do you know what I mean? I'm an addict, a Tupperware addict. I'm ordering much more than I need, and I can't stop myself. It's part of my upbringing, part of my heritage.
Don't tell me.
Looney Lisa.
This is a pocket comb, or you can massage your scalp, or scrub your vegetables, or pet your cat. Please use it for only one of those following things. This might be a fact that you don't know. You do not burp square containers. Only round seals do you burp.
This is called the scrape-em-all.
This is probably my seventh or eighth Tupperware party. And at every Tupperware party, you feel like you need to buy one thing for the hostess. So here I am buying a Shapo.
I think it takes a lot of courage to have a Tupperware party.
As long as it hasn't, you know, been abused, the Tupperware.
I've got Tupperware that I've had for 30 years, I guess, and most of it's good yet.
My mother always used Tupperware, and I remember after every holiday, like at Passover, Rosh Hashanah, all the leftover simis and gefilte fish went into the Tupperware containers.
These are our ultra-clear counterparts. When President Reagan was in the hospital, when she was going up the steps, she had a container full of jelly beans, and that was a Tupperware counterpart that was given to them by Justin Dart. You know, Dart Industries and Kraft and Tupperware are all one big family now. Did you know that? So they came out with our new butter and cheese keeper.
Justin Dart, he's a very special man.
He was instrumental in Ronald Reagan's drive for governor, and he had a significant part to play in his presidential bid also.
any hors d'oeuvre, and you can lay toothpicks on the side here to use to serve.
You can always tell a Tupperware lady.
We start our rallies with the songs, and it really brightens up your Monday mornings. It just brightens your spirits, and you're set for the week. Even a brand new dealer, she might be some person that's been out of the job market for a while, and family and husband kind of take advantage of her, and she'll come into rally, and everybody makes her feel really special because she had a good week.
We had a new house and a new baby and a lot of bills, and I needed a job that I could be home, you know, with the children, but get out and make some money too, and this seemed ideal for me. We came to the country 14 years ago because we knew it was the land of opportunity. Tupperware really showed us it was.
Tomorrow's my 12th year in Tupperware. I used to be a deputy sheriff. I had done that for 10 years. After 6 months, I quit that security job I had, and then 3 months later, I became a manager, and I love it.
What do you like about it?
The money. I love the positive input instead of the negativeness that I used to have in law enforcement.
Money. Nine. Money. Five. Money. Three.
Is your husband at all involved with this?
Very much so. He does all my ordering. He does all my postcards. My son now bags my Tupperware. Most of my friends, they just sat back and just waited for me to fail. And he was doing that at first because he just didn't see any future in this. Now you should talk to him. If I quit, he wouldn't be too happy. It's really an advantage to have a husband that's involved. I don't have that privilege. My husband just laughs. He says, oh, another plastic bowl party.
There are so many more women in the business than there are men. But when they come in, if they do well, they go to the top. They will move faster than a woman does.
My wife and I, we've been running the business for 2.5 years now, and we're going to sell $1.25 million this year, which is not too bad for mom and pop business.
Is there a Tupperware union?
No. It's an opportunity company. Anybody's welcome to join to be a Tupperware dealer. Tupperware treats you so well, you wouldn't have anything to bargain for.
And what are the fringe benefits of Tupperware?
Your buying power to buy Tupperware, the gifts that you earned. The last contest that we have, I earned an American of Martinsville sofa.
I've earned an Oregon and microwave.
I've won a trip. I've gotten a brass bed.
And of course, I guess you know Tupperware gives us cars, too.
I've won a $900 set of Norotaki china.
Diamond enameled ring from Tupperware.
Crystal dinner bell.
My station wagon. I mean, I have a brand new station wagon
just about every year. Little feminine things that women love. Twice a year you go to conventions. You can walk into the auditorium the first day and you can cut the excitement with a knife. That's called Jubilee.
One is in Utah and the other is in the world headquarters in Orlando, Florida. It's like a rally which lasted for 2.5 hours tonight here. It goes on for 3 days.
There were 700 Tupperware ladies in the room and they brought out the food and there's no salt and pepper on the table. Well, pretty soon somebody's up at the podium and says, oh my goodness, we forgot the salt and pepper shakers. And then they blow the trumpets and everything, and they drop the screen down. They show our new salt and pepper shaker. They really keep us entertained. This year, it was called the Big Country Jubilee, and everybody dressed in, you know, like hee-haw, and one whole distributorship went as Dolly Parton's.
I've got the Tupper feeling up in my head, up in my head.
If you're the type of person that likes to sit at an airport and watch people, this is a job for you.
Why am I retiring from Tupperware?
You have to drag this Tupperware out of your house every night, right? Into the car and into somebody else's house. And it's a real chore.
It changed my life. It gives me a leftover mentality.
Actually, most people are potential Tupperware dealers. They really are.
Down in my toes, down in my toes, down in my toes. I got the Tupper feeling down in my toes.
And that story came to us from the Kitchen Sisters. And a fun little fact to add here, Earl Tupper, the man behind Tupperware, was born in Berlin, New Hampshire.
Yes, there's a party going on at Mrs. Betty Martin's house. It's a Tupperware party, and it's really fun. The girls get together and meet their old friends and make some new ones. Then there's a demonstration by one of the Tupperware dealers who lives in your community. Hear that? That's Tupperware's airtight promise to lock in flavor and lock out air. So salads keep their... and gelatin desserts keep their... Since Tupperware can't spill or leak, you can store it any which way in your freezer or refrigerator.
And when word of mouth returns, we call a snow day, the surprise play day for kids and the bane of working parents. A day off of school for bad weather is a big decision for local superintendents. We're going to talk to a researcher about why it's better to err on the side of caution and call a snow day. That's when word of mouth continues after a short break.
Thank you.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth. Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's every kid's nightmare, waking up to find 6 or 7 inches of fresh snow covering the roads, only to find out that for some inexplicable reason, school is still on. It is the Yankee way to press on and go about our business, whatever the weather. Plus, canceling school is tough on working parents, and then there's all those missed lessons. One researcher proposes that schools might be better off closing their doors than persevering. Joshua Goodman is assistant professor of public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Joshua, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So why might students be better off academically not going to school during inclement weather?
That's right. So I think the answer is, and I should preface this by saying that I was a public high school teacher, a math teacher for a couple of years before becoming an academic. When you cancel school, it's obviously disruptive to families in all sorts of ways, but it's actually not very hard for a teacher to deal with, because all that means for a teacher is you push your lesson plans back a day, and when the kids come back to school, they're all in the same place where you left them, roughly. What's much harder to deal with is if you keep school open and because of the snow, 5 of your kids are absent, and then you have to figure out, well, do I keep going with my lesson plan and teach the 20 kids who are here? And if that's the case, what do I do with the 5 kids when they come back to school the next day? And that's the kind of challenge that I think is actually harder for teachers to deal with, coordinating absent students.
That's like 20% of the class. You know, that's significant.
That's right. Well, yeah. So I should say that, what I was finding in my data is that when schools would stay open during snowy weather, it usually caused something like 2 or 3 students to be absent who wouldn't have otherwise. And even that's enough to be challenging for a teacher to deal with and take time away from the regular flow of the classroom.
So the key you're saying is keep them all in the same place academically. Now, did your data find this true across the board, across the socioeconomic spectrum, for example?
Yeah, no, it seems like this phenomenon is fairly widespread. And I will say, I think, I did this study here in Massachusetts, and I think, schools and teachers in Massachusetts are probably particularly used to dealing with snow days. I think the situation would be different when you have places like last year. I think Atlanta had to shut down for a long period of time, and they were shocked because they'd never dealt with sort of snow and that kind of bad weather. So I do think those of us in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire are a little bit used to dealing with snow, and so that means that closing schools is not quite as disruptive to classrooms as it might otherwise be.
I was thinking in rural areas in New Hampshire where longer distances are traveled, maybe you'd have more kids out if the weather was better.
That's true. So my research certainly does suggest that that if you're in a place where keeping school open means you'd only get half of your students showing up, that it's not clear that that's a great idea. I should be clear that my study was really about, how much they're learning and what kind of test scores they get at the end of the year. Test scores are not the only thing we care about when we run schools. We care about taking care of kids. We care about allowing parents to go to their jobs. And of course, one major thing here is we care about student safety. So I actually wouldn't think that test scores and student learning are the first thing that schools and superintendents should think about when deciding about closing or keeping schools open. I just think they should keep it in mind as sort of one of many things that they should be thinking about.
How about just a better system of catching kids up when they've missed time?
I think that's an absolutely wonderful point. So it's tough for teachers to catch kids who've been absent up with the material. One thing that I think will change over time, and I think has changed in schools, is now that schools are getting better and better about using the internet to allow parents to check on, kids' progress and sort of whether they've turned in homeworks. It might be that, at some point we live in a world where even if school shuts down or a kid is absent and sitting at home, the teacher can still send them part of the assignment to actually do. And so there might be ways in which technology is going to help us deal with these disruptions to classrooms.
I'm also wondering if they could attend class remotely, which would be possible for a lot of connected kids.
That's right. So, right, I, in theory, you could set up some kind of, you know, Skype session with, where, put some iPads in, and apps in desks that are empty. Although I have to say, as a teacher, I would find that very disruptive to have 20 live students and five, images of kids being beamed from other places. That might be challenging to deal with.
So in closing, Joshua, any advice for school superintendents who are making these kind of decisions? Can you quantify, how much snow is too much, how little?
No, I don't think I want to draw any bright lines here, but I actually think the point that schools should think very carefully about exactly what you said, which is how do we as a school and we as teachers deal with kids who are absent and missing time? I think that's actually the key question here, is if we can come up with better ways to help catch kids up, that will actually solve a lot of the challenges that I outlined in this research.
Joshua Goodman, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Joshua Goodman, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. You can find a link to read his study, Flaking Out, Snowfall Disruptions and Instruction Time and Student Achievement. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org.
City cannot handle snow when it sticks nowhere to go. Streets are empty when they're frozen. Don't you know you're stranded? Jobs are stupid, so we quit. Cars are stuck, we let them sit. And there's nothing wrong with
If you're one of the unfortunate ones to catch it, you already know that this year's flu season has been particularly bad and is shaping up to be one of the worst in recent years. The Center for Disease Control is reporting widespread flu activity in 44 states, but it's certainly not the first time the U.S. has dealt with this kind of contagion. In this segment from Backstory, the American History Guys and producer Catherine Moore explain how soldiers returning from World War I brought the Spanish flu back with them.
Now, normally, the very old and the very young are hit hardest by the flu. You guys know that already. But in 1918, something strange happened. The group hardest hit was healthy young adults. Hospital wards were full of dying 23-year-olds. And that demographic anomaly matters because of what else was going on in 1918. World War I.
And if you were the malevolent public health official and wanted to create an environment that would facilitate transmission of influenza, you would create trench warfare. That was an absolutely perfect place for that virus to go.
Those 23-year-olds, not only were they especially susceptible to influenza, they were being concentrated in military barracks where the disease could easily be passed from one to the next, and they were being shipped from military base to military base, both here in the States and around the world. Dr. Gaines read to us from a letter written by an Army doctor describing the carnage left by the flu at a military base near Boston.
We have lost an outrageous number of nurses and doctors, and the little town around here is a sight. It takes special trains to carry away the dead. For several days, there were no coffins, and the bodies piled up something fierce. We used to go down to the morgue and look at all the boys laid out in long rows. It beats any sight they ever had in France, I'll bet.
The 500-bed hospital where the doctor worked was in Camp Devens, Massachusetts. And a few weeks before he composed that letter, a trainload of soldiers from Camp Devens was transferred to Philadelphia. A number of them were already infected. Backstory contributor Catherine Moore is going to tell us the story of what happened next.
Picture the Port of Philadelphia, 1918. Workers at the largest shipyard in the world are grinding out warships. Over at the Navy Yard, sailors are scurrying in what would be the final months of their efforts to beat back the Hun. A few blocks away, the streets are packed. It's not just any crowd. It's a parade, a Liberty Loan parade, kicking off the government's latest effort to fill up its war coffer. Each state must do its part to meet the country's $6 billion goal.
If you can't enlist, invest.
A poster drives home the by now familiar message that true patriots put their money where their mouth is.
Every Liberty bond is a shot at a U-boat. crush the Prussian, buy a bond.
At the parade, spectacles abound. People lean out of windows to see an aircraft hull rolling down the avenue. Warplanes fly overhead. Songs and speeches cajole people into buying bonds. And over at Willow Grove Park, John Philip Sousa strikes up his band. That was the scene on September 28th. 3 weeks later, over 12,000 Philadelphians would be dead from the Spanish flu. Let's back up. Philly's ticking time bomb really begins on September 7th, when 300 soldiers from flu-stricken Boston arrive at the Philadelphia Navy Yard. By the 15th, 600 sailors here report sick. And just in case you're picturing a bunch of guys with achiness and some fever, consider that symptoms from the Spanish flu included frothing blood, brown spots, bleeding from the eyes and ears, and turning blue. So blue, in some cases, that one doctor found it hard to distinguish between his black and white patients. The Naval Hospital runs out of beds. Patients are sent to the civilian hospital, where three-quarters of the medical staff is overseas at war. Meantime, soldiers have left Philadelphia on boats and trains, crisscrossing the country. Many are gravely ill upon arrival. And all this time, Philadelphia authorities haven't done much of anything except deny that there's a threat at all. And the press isn't exactly helping to ring the alarm bell. The news of the day was often told with a cheerful spin as editors strained to keep up morale. In fact, the Spanish flu gets its nickname from the fact that Spain, a neutral country, didn't censor the horrors of the epidemic in its papers. Finally, on the 18th, a PR campaign is launched. A polite poster is printed.
When obliged to cough or sneeze, always place a handkerchief, paper napkin, or fabric of some kind before the face.
By the end of the epidemic, the signs would read,
spitting equals death.
There's some pressure to call off the parade, but perhaps more than disease, authorities fear public panic. A panicked country, after all, can't win a war. And so the parade goes forward, and hundreds of sailors from the flu-ravaged Navy Yard rub elbows with a crowd of 200,000 that stretches for miles. Within 72 hours, about the time it takes for the flu infection to develop, every hospital bed in the city's full. And over the next several weeks, 12,000 Philadelphians will die. Wagons will roam the streets, medieval style, collecting the dead. Corpses will be stacked in tenement hallways. They will be buried in mass graves with steam shovels. In the end, six times as many Americans would die from the flu than on the battlefield in World War I. But when the nation wrapped up its bond drive on October 19th, at roughly the peak of the epidemic in Philadelphia, the country had met and exceeded its war bond quota.
That piece comes to us from reporter Catherine Moore. You can hear more of Catherine's pieces on our website, backstoryradio.org.
Boy, that's some powerful stuff, isn't it, Peter?
Yeah.
It sounds a lot like what we were talking about earlier in the show about the epidemic in Philadelphia back in 1793. What's changed?
Well, what's striking is government could do nothing then, and it could do nothing in World War I. But there was capacity in government. In fact, that's part of the problem, isn't it, Ryan? I mean, they could mobilize all those people.
We did. And look, we were very slow to mobilize for World War I. Let's not kid ourselves. Mm-hmm. But once that mobilization got going, it was a juggernaut. And you can hear that in Catherine's piece. $6 billion for a bond drive, millions of Americans contributing it. So, you know, a lot has changed. But it turns out that dysfunction can be just as lethal as heading for the hills back in your days, Peter.
Yeah, well, we're talking about urbanization and density in the instant cities. In a way, public health measures had made cities safer, But this was bringing people together on the streets, and that was just an incubator of contagion.
And that story came to us from Backstory with the American History Guys. You can find out much more about the show at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for listening on this cold winter's day. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. You just never know what you'll learn by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come on back for more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.